everybody. It's going to be lovely tomorrow. Well, it's been quite lovely today, actually. Have you had a good day, Mr. Mayor?
Terrific day. Thanks very much. I did assume that no one would be here. I thought you'd have other things to do.
It's raining.
That's true. Oh, I suppose there's nothing else to do, really. Well, we'll keep you dry.
We're going to talk a bit about Simon and his book. We'll take some questions towards the end, and we will have a jolly good time. Is it your first Greenbelt?
It's actually 41st, genuinely. Isn't that ridiculous?
It's lovely.
Thank you. That's the easiest round of applause ever.
And what sort of
41.
Things...
41.
What sort of things have you done here over the years?
41! I stopped listening at about 30. Sorry, what was that?
What sort of things have you done here in the 41 years?
You mean things I've been to or...
Whatever you like.
I've sat on stages like this and we've done a few games and I talked about books. And we did a Radio 1 roadshow on a Sunday night with the Proclaimers playing live. Anyone remember that? That was amazing. And they were singing Sunshine on Leith and the sun was setting. I have no idea where we were. Was it Dean Park, Castle Ashby? One of them. Nebworth? Odell? I don't know. It was one of those places. But that was fantastic. You know, doing a live radio show was good. And the Proclaimers were very impressive.
So why do you keep coming back?
I get a free ticket. Actually, that's not true. We always thought that we wanted to come and then we wanted it to still be around for our kids. And then and now the kids all come. So it seemed to be a wise thing to do, really.
Well, it's a pleasure. Well, pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here most of the time.
I'm going to move into the more formal part of the interview now.
Okay.
What does a typical Simon Mayo day look like?
There isn't one, really, but I could pick on a day which would involve maybe going to a screening for a film. It's usually about 10 or 11 o'clock. Then I'd either be doing that or I'd be doing some writing or some research, something like that. Do a bit of prep and then turn up at work about 3 o'clock and then leave a bit later than that.
Mm. See Mrs. Mayo?
Mrs. Mayo I see in the morning, yeah, and then usually in the evening, yeah.
That's nice.
That's right.
Do you write every day?
I'd like to. I feel as though I should, because the more you write, the easier it is to write, even if it's just a paragraph, even if it's just a few sentences, even if you just corrected a sentence that you've already written and thought it was quite good, and then when you wake up and you realise that it's not quite so good. So I would like to do that, but inevitably all the other stuff gets in the way. So it ends up, I haven't written anything for a week. So I feel as though I have been busy doing other things. I do feel a bit rusty. But one of the good things about getting back into the system next week is that there'll be some kind of routine and I can crack on with this new story which I'm writing.
I'll ask you about that later.
Okay.
Not every fabulously successful DJ manages to become a writer. So no. What made you think you could do it? Who inspired you?
That's a very interesting question because I never... I've interviewed hundreds of authors and talked about hundreds of books, and all of them have in common they either always wanted to write or they have always written. And that was never the case for me. It never occurred to me to write a book until... there was a juxtaposition of a whole bunch of things happened. I left Five Live, where we talked about books an awful lot. My son came back from school only interested in science, and I stopped writing a newspaper column, and I had some writing time, and this was exactly the time that the iPad came out, which is relevant because if anyone was an early iPad adopter, there was a particular app which you could get, which is about the periodic table. And it was an extraordinary interactive periodic table, which you could spin various rocks around, and it could do things which you couldn't do on a phone or on a computer. And I thought it was brilliant. And in that discussion, in that all the information about the periodic table, it talked about someone who, if you collected the periodic table, you were called an element hunter. And I thought it was the coolest thing, you know. And if you were a kid who, or a grown-up, who wouldn't want to be an element hunter? So it occurred to me that that might make the basis of a good story. So I thought I'd write a short story for Joe, who's my son, younger son. And it sort of, it all kind of came from there. Instead of it being a short story, it was 100,000 words. And I didn't have a publisher, and I didn't have an agent or anything like that. I just thought I'd write it for him. Some of you will have heard this story before. But anyway, I literally then pressed print and printed it off on A4 sheets and gave it to him and said, there you go. That's what I've been writing. So he read it and he thought it was all right. So I then found a publisher and it went from there. So I kind of stumbled into it. So I stumbled into that story. I stumbled into writing. I stumbled into the next book, Blame, and I stumbled into this story as well. So it might appear as though it's all well planned, but it absolutely isn't.
And when you're at work, do other very famous DJs say to you, could you advise me on how to start writing books, Simon? Steve Wright in the corridor?
I have to say no one has said that, no. Other folk at work have written books. They haven't written... Actually, Dermot O'Leary has written a kid's book. Others have written like memoirs or books about music, but I think it's an unusual thing. Hey, I surprised myself. I didn't know, you know, I didn't think I could do it at all.
But you're owning that territory now.
I'm probably the best-selling novel writer at Radio 2. I would guess.
It's an accolade.
Yeah, it's an accolade. Yeah, I mean, it's not an incredible accolade, I have to say.
The move from Blame into your first adult novel.
Yes.
Adult, written for adults.
Yes, adult novel does sound as though it's one kind of book.
Yeah, we'll come on to that later.
Yeah.
So where did you find this story?
So this story here, which is called Mad Blood Stirring, is something that I stumbled onto when I was... the last book was called Blame, which was the one with the bright orange cover. And at the end of it, I needed to have a prison in the southwest of England for the denouement to take place in. And the most famous prison in the southwest is Dartmoor Prison. And I was just starting to, and I was just researched Dartmoor Prison and was looking for some facts and figures. And I found this story, which I thought was really fascinating. And it was so fascinating, I didn't need it really for the end of Blame. So I sent them to Bodmin instead. And then I went back to Dartmoor and researched more and more about Dartmoor Prison. And the more I found out about it, the more extraordinary the story was. So in brief, this is all the factual side of it. Dartmoor Prison, I mean, many of you will have driven past Dartmoor Prison. Some of you might even have been in Dartmoor Prison, I don't know. But anyway, it's still a prison now. It's a Category 3 prison. It's built in 1807 for the prisoners of the war against Napoleon. So it was full of French soldiers. As that, the first part of the war against Napoleon was sorted, the French left, and Britain was also fighting at the same time a thing which is known as the War of 1812. This is because it's a war and it started in 1812. It hasn't got a very glamorous name, and it's a kind of a squalid little war, didn't really change anything. But Britain was fighting America again. And as most of the battles were at sea, we were taking a lot of American sailors prisoner, and 7,000 of them ended up in Dartmoor Prison. So in 1814, Dartmoor Prison was full of American sailors. And the accommodation in Dartmoor Prison is in seven blocks, each one holding 1,000 sailors. And at the request of the white American sailors, the prisons were segregated. Is it the only time in British history that there's been a racially segregated prison in the UK mainland? And all the non-white prisoners were put in prison four, which was in the middle. I thought that was a startling piece of information. And at this time, Poldark was on TV for the first time, which is sort of the same kind of period, and it's just down the road. But this story felt like a very different story to Poldark. So I think, okay, Prison 4 is an interesting place. Then I discovered that Prison 4 was kind of run by one guy, and he was a prisoner. He was 6'7". He had a club in his hand. He had a bearskin hat on his head all the time. He called himself King Dick, and he was a gangster and a thug, and he was also a theatrical impresario. And in 1814, he put on Othello and Romeo and Juliet in Dartmoor Prison. And when it got to the Romeo and Juliet bit, I thought, that's a story, okay? Now, that is a story. So Mad Blood Stirring, which is a quote from Romeo and Juliet, is a kind of a reimagining of Romeo and Juliet as set in Dartmoor Prison in 1814. The story of the Americans in Dartmoor ends in a massacre. It's a bit of a spoiler, I realize. But anyway, April the 6th, 1815, there's a tragedy, a real-life tragedy. And as Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's most famous tragedies, I thought I could run the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet into the tragedy of what actually happened on April the 6th. So that's all the truth. And into that, I've put in a whole bunch of stuff I've made up.
The character of King Dick is an astonishing character and very, very well written, if I may say.
Well, okay. So the challenge of King Dick was, well, a whole bunch of challenges with this story. First of all, I was more aware than ever before that I am a white Londoner, and we spend a lot of time in the book in Prison 4. So we're spending a lot of time in the squalor. I mean, it's a desperate, desperate place. And all of the people in Block 4, they come from different places. Most of them come from America. Some of them are free men. Some of them are escaped slaves. Some of them come from the Caribbean. Some of them come from West Africa. Some of them come from the United States. So how do they talk? How do they speak? We don't know, is the answer. How did King Dick talk? We don't know. So I had to give an approximation of how I thought they might have spoken. And the challenge with King Dick, given that he is 6'7", bearskin hat, club, all that, was making him believable and trying to make him not cartoonish, because that he said that, you know, if I had created that character, you'd be thinking, I don't believe him for a moment. But all of that is actually true. So I wanted to come up with this guy and also try and answer the question, how come he loves Shakespeare? How has this thug and gangster got to love Shakespeare? So it's a kind of a combination of all of that to try and make him believable, to try and make him other, to make him separate from all the others.
Did you like him?
I did like him, yes. I think he's a complicated guy, and he is a thug and prone to random acts of violence, which is why he's the king. And he gets the respect of the block, and he gets the respect of the British, who like the way he runs things. All the white prisons, so 1 to 3, and obviously 5 to 7, are run by committees. They're run by prisoner committees, and they vote for things. And the British don't like that because it's all chaotic and a bit messy. King Dick, they like. So they like to deal with him because he has power and he runs the place. So they only have to deal with him, and he makes things happen.
Would you like to read a bit from your book?
Yes, I can read a book. Yes, I can.
Is it the right time? We can do it.
Yeah. I can. If you're ready, if you're up for it.
Anyone not ready? You're not ready.
Okay, well, let's wait. Can you put your hand up when you're ready?
Let us know when you're not.
Let's just wait.
You ready now?
Are you ready?
Yeah,
he's
ready.
Okay, that's good.
Okay. Is your dad, Becky? He's ready now.
Dartmoor Prison, because they're prisoners of war, this is not like a regular prison. And one of the things that took place, they had a daily market every day apart from Sunday. They were paid a wage by the American government, and the British distributed this money. It was tuppence halfpenny a week, and they could buy, in the market, they could buy meat, they could buy clothing, they could buy beer, they could buy all kinds of grog. You know, it's a fairly extraordinary place. There's a lot of money in this prison, and there's a lot of alcohol floating around. I'm sure they could buy waterproofs and overpriced pizza as well, but there you go. £14? Anyway. It's very nice. But anyway, £14. Anyway, so this takes place in the market square. And what's happened prior to this is that a couple of members of Prison 4 have been beaten up and attacked by a racist gang that operates within Dartmoor Prison, who are called the Rough Allies. And Dick isn't having any of that. I'm going to stand. It feels a bit more theatrical if I do it like this, and you can see me.
Do you need more room?
No, it's fine. I don't. One stage is enough. Unlike everyone else, King Dick wasn't shopping. He stood momentarily by the lower gates, surveying the square in front of him, head high, club loosely resting in the crook of his neck like a shouldered rifle, his eyes darting from stall to stall. Predator, thought Joe. Oh, I should say that the two main characters in the book, other than Dick, are a white English sailor, a white American sailor called Joe, and a black American sailor who's called Habs. Predator, thought Joe, the word flashing across his mind as the king spotted his prey. He moved with deadly purpose and precision, his eyes locked on his target. When they saw him coming, the crowd moved aside. Where they didn't, he used his club. Men were pushed into stalls in his wake. Betsy hastily scooped the remaining loaves to her chest. Joe and Martha threw what they could into a basket seconds before three men fell onto a table, splitting the wood in two places. Joe watched the king move, then looked at Habs. This is what he does, isn't it? This is what he does, and this is how he does it, agreed Habs. It's why he's the king. Habs and Joe pushed their way towards the melee, reaching the beer tables just after King Dick. The crowd here was slower to respond, and the king cut a sway through the revelers, Habs and Joe stepping gingerly over the bruised and battered. The king forced his way to where three heavily bearded men stood laughing and toasting each other with large jugs of ale. One spotted his arrival and fled. The others were too slow and too late. That's Parker and Tupper from Six, said Habs, speaking quickly in Joe's ear. And that was Wilson who ran away. Last night they set upon two of our men from Four. An eye for an eye, then. Goddamn right, they're villains and thugs, and they got away with it till King Dick came, said Habs. The clouds had thinned, the light in the square now brighter than it had been all day. It gave each man present a sharply defined shadow. For a few moments, the king stood motionless, hands on hips, club swinging on its strap, his eyes fixed on the startled, trembling men in front of him. Parker was hunched and round-faced, his friend shorter and heavier. They both looked as though they were trying to speak, but no words came out of their mouths. No one moved. No one made a sound. Habs and Joe held their breath, waiting for the show to begin. Habs counted the silence. He reached 15. Then, in a swift lunge, King Dick stooped down and grabbed the smaller of the two men by his ankles. As he rose up, the man fell, his head cracking against the granite. He howled, and the king adjusted his grip, one hand now on the drinker's leg, the other on the man's belt. The king had a new club. He was called Tupper. The men of Four are, by providence, my men, he bellowed at Parker, who still stood despite his trembling. The king began to brandish his new club. The club started to howl. Those who found themselves nearest his swinging arc stepped back a few paces. So when you Christian white savages attack my men, you attack me. I am the men of Four, he cried, and swung the club. The rough ally Parker was still holding his beer when his friend's head crashed into his ribs. As he tottered backwards, the king swung again, and two heads cracked. Like a rifle shot, the sound bounced around the walled square, and the king dropped one unconscious man on top of the other. Tupper on Parker, legs splayed, heads blooded. The king surveyed the damage, straightened his hat, brushed down his coat. and strode away. Habs applauded solemnly. Joe was astonished. "I have never, in 2 years of war, seen anything like that," he said. And there are a number of reports of Dick behaving and doing exactly that, of picking somebody up by the ankles and grabbing him one hand on his leg, one hand on a belt, and swinging him and using him as a club. So I think that was quite an exciting thing to do.
So who was writing those reports then that you were using for research?
When all the most of Dartmoor records were lost in a fire, but so most of the accounts that we have come from the white American sailors who went home and they wrote memoirs, and some of them were best-selling memoirs. So, you know, much like it would happen today. So there are a number of accounts of prisoners and what daily life was like and what they spent their time doing. And one of the sort of tantalizing glimpses of life in Dartmoor Prison, there are a number of them who talk about on a Sunday calling in, this from the white prisoners, calling in prison four and listening to the amazing choir that were singing in prison four. And that's it. There's just a few references to that. They just talk about the choir. And I had a conversation over a period of time with Basil Mead, who a number of you will have seen, the man who set up London Community Gospel Choir. And I said to Basil Mead, in theory, black gospel music didn't turn up in the UK until towards the end of the 19th century. But what else is this choir singing? These are, as I mentioned, they're escaped slaves, former slaves. This is a gospel choir. And I gave the book to Basil, and he said, I think you're right. So I think 1814 is now the first time that black gospel music turned up in the United Kingdom, even though very few people could hear it. So I've got some gospel music in the book. It's quite a lot of music in the book. I also think that it's the first black Shakespeare in Britain, because I don't, you know, in terms of a black production company, if you like. So I think that this production of Othello, which came first, and then Romeo and Juliet, are historic, really.
And were there clues in those documents as to why King Dick was both a theatrical impresario and a thug?
No, none at all. I mean, basically, King Dick, whose real name is Richard Crafus, and we know he came from Maryland. We know how old he was, but basically, he's a complete blank canvas. So he's 27 years old when he arrives in Dartmoor, and that's it. That's all we know. So the British keep records, and so it was a question of constructing him completely from scratch, really. But he's clearly a man of power, clearly a man of authority. My guess is that he was a free man when he arrived in Dartmoor. Well, he'd been captured, but you know he wasn't an escaped slave. But I have no way of knowing that.
Could we spend a few moments with Mrs. Shortland?
Yes.
Is she made up?
Okay, so the agent is the guy who runs it. So the man who you'd probably call the prison governor is known as the agent. His name is Thomas Shortland. He's a captain in the Royal Navy, and he's married to Elizabeth Shortland. And they are both real characters. So Elizabeth Shortland did exist. One of the main characters in the book is Elizabeth Shortland. This is not, I mean, I did, it's obviously, it's a men's prison and they're guarded by men. So it is a blokey book by its very nature. There are some women who are in the market. You heard them referred to there, Betsy and Mary, who run a stall. But Elizabeth Shortland was a real woman. I have made her very significant to the story because it felt as though the story needed a different perspective, so that we see the prison and we see the conflict through her eyes, and she sees it very differently to everybody else. So she is what is known as a point of view character. So we follow Joe. In fact, we arrive with Joe at the beginning of the story. He's just been captured, and he arrives and he announces that the war has finished. The reason why it's increasingly chaotic through the book is because peace is declared right at the beginning of the book, but these guys don't get out for 4 months. And they're saying, if there's not a prison, if there's not a war, how can I be a prisoner of war? Anyway, so we arrive with Joe. He makes friends with Habs, who's been there a while. So we see the conflict from both their points of view. And the other point of view is Elizabeth Shortland, who is a particular type of... She has a particular voice, which I think is best expressed. There was a woman. There was a book came out a number of years ago called Daughters of Britannia, which was all about the women, wives and daughters who went with British ambassadors when they were posted abroad. They weren't allowed to be ambassadors themselves. So this is a collection of letters, a collection of voices that we don't normally hear. And there's a particular type of woman who is writing back. And Elizabeth Shortland is a daughter of Britannia. She thought she was marrying into a glamorous lifestyle, maybe may get a beautiful posting somewhere abroad, and she thought life was going to be exotic. And actually, she ends up in the middle of Dartmoor, which is, as a lot of you know, a pretty horrendous place, even in the summer. So, so that's her.
So my favourite word in the book comes out of your description of Mrs. Shortland. Do you know what the word might be?
No, I can't remember.
Chemisette.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well...
What is a chemisette?
It's a... Okay, so this is... I'm describing the way she looks and what she's wearing.
Yeah, it's just a moment of femininity that drops into this bleak, brutal environment, and it just... I loved it.
Yeah, she is... I was trying to imagine what life would be like for the only woman in amongst 7,000 prisoners and the best part of 1,000 troops, and imagining what her life would be like. So she is having a romantic interlude with the physician. I made that bit up. I have no reason to believe that they did, but I thought it would make her life more interesting.
You experienced the romantic interlude yourself, though. That's not made up, is it?
Say again?
You're familiar with the idea of a romantic interlude.
Not in the way that she's having one with the physician.
No. Looks at Mrs. Mayo.
No, I that's what a writer does. A writer has some imagination. I don't think I could say, yes, hello, dear. For research for my book, I thought I'd have a romantic interlude. I'll just see what happens. Let me buy you a chemisette. And see what happens. So absolutely, she is a beacon of femininity in amongst this kind of ghastly swathe of prisoners, who get increasingly desperate. And there is, if anyone knows their Romeo and Juliet, I've tried to follow the pattern of Romeo and Juliet in the telling of this story, because it ends with the production of Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet is told over five acts, and it's all over very quickly, in 4.5 days, in fact. This takes place over 4.5 months. And there's a moment at the beginning of Act 3 in Romeo and Juliet where there's a murder, and everything kind of spirals out of control from that point. And my book sort of follows the same pattern, and there's a character in there who's murdered at the beginning of Act 3, and from that point, everything sort of starts to get out of control.
And do you like Shakespeare more as a result of writing the book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Shakespeare expert, and I had never read Romeo and Juliet all the way through until I started this story, but that was the starting point of telling the story. But what amazed me was that it's a common experience for us when we go and watch Shakespeare, and it takes a while to get into the rhythm of the language. What startled me was thinking the power of this story worked under these circumstances in 1814, where we have a play being put on by American sailors in the most kind of distressed circumstances imaginable, and they loved doing Shakespeare. They loved doing Othello, and they loved doing Romeo and Juliet. So there is a power to the story which captivated them, and I think it just underlined what an extraordinary set of stories and what an extraordinary set of characters they are.
Your descriptions of Dartmoor are pretty... You went there and you... Oh, I think what I'm trying to get to is you quite like prisons.
Blame is set in a prison. Blame is set in it like an imaginary version of a prison set between Holloway... Well, it's sort of mainly set in a version of Holloway Prison which is now shut down. But anyway, but it was coincidence, really, that I've written two prison books. But Blame was set in a prison, yes. But Dartmoor is like a whole different ball game altogether. Dartmoor, it looks as though it was constructed with the sole purpose of terrifying anybody who sees it. And now when you walk round it or drive around, you think, this is horrific. There is still there is a museum which is attached, and you can go into the museum, and that's horrific enough. But when you walk round the walls and you look into it, and you know that inside the conditions are good because it's all governed by proper legislation, but it looks horrific. The new book doesn't have any prisons in it. It is just coincidence, I think, that I've written two prison books.
What's the new book about? Can you say?
No, I can't. Well, I'm not entirely sure myself. I've just sort of I'm just off on an adventure.
Okay, I'm going to go back to prisons then. So, Masha, who is here with Pussy Riot, she's written a book called Riot Days, and in it she gets sent to prison for 2 years to Gulag in the Urals. And you understand from her writing how important the regime is in the prison. So that anyone who upends the regime or challenges the regime is a massive pain to the people who are running it. And so I was wondering whether you had thought about King Dick in that way, that he challenges, but then they work with him. So it's...
No, so the regime, as I said, they're prisoners of war. So it's a slightly different set of circumstances. They haven't committed a crime. They've just been caught fighting the British. And there's a lot of autonomy which is given to each of the prison blocks. So they vote on, for example, they choose their own food. They choose their own punishment. The punishments in the blocks, which the sailors have chosen for themselves, are even more brutal than the punishments the British mete out. You know, this is a tough, brutal, horrible place to be. You know, 50 lashes would not be, if you were caught stealing money or taking extra bread, the Americans decided that their punishment for their fellow sailors was 50 lashes. You know, this is brutal stuff. But as far as King Dick was different, but the British liked it. And each act in the book, there are five acts, each section of the book finishes with a conversation in dialogue form between Agent Shortland and King Dick, because I imagine them both as tribal leaders speaking as equals to each other. So, yes, he changed the system and he upended the system, but in a way that, bizarrely, the men in prison four liked it, and the British liked it as well. It's just everyone else hated it. I mean, I think this became more important as I went through the book. The act of segregation, which is at the heart of the book, which is where the white Americans, I have to underline this point, the sailors, when they'd been fighting the British, were all in boats and ships together. There was no segregation in the Navy because there wasn't room for segregation in the Navy. The Army was segregated, the Navy and the merchant ships were not. The first thing they do when they get onto dry land is that they ask the British to be separate. So these are your comrades. You've been fighting the British, and yet the first thing they want to do is they go to the British and they say, we want to be separate. And so the more I went through the more I thought about that, the more significant that became in the writing of the book. And Charlottesville happened halfway through the book. So the race side of the story just sort of escalated and became more and more important as the story went through.
I've got two more questions, and I'm going to open it up to you if you're thinking about your questions for Simon. When you had finished writing it, was there anything about 1815 or that period of history when you thought, that's a shame that doesn't happen now? Or were you really glad to leave there? Is there anything to recommend it?
that's an interesting question. I have to say, I can't think of anything about 1815 that I would want to go back to. The chemisette, I'm sure you could wear a chemisette. I'm sure you could get a green belt tattooed.
What is a chemisette?
It's a form of chemise. It's a smaller chemise.
Is that a sort of diaphanous see-through nightie?
If you'd like to imagine it as such. I think you can get one at the tent just over there. See-through originally, but it's got a little bit wet and it is now.
If we're not selling them this year, we will be next year.
No, 1815 was it's just awful. And there's an outbreak of smallpox in the course of the story, and which is true, which also happened. And I can't think of anything more horrendous, I think, than to be in a prison under the circumstances they were being held. The war was over, they want to get home, and then there's an outbreak of smallpox. So I think that's particularly grim. I mean, there are some moments in the book, hopefully there are some moments of beauty, and there are some, you know, there are some lighter moments. In fact, quite a few lighter moments. And it's a coming-of-age story, and it's a love story. But there is no, I wouldn't recommend 1815 to anybody, no. I can't think of a single thing that that was better.
Because Aidan Turner has really sold me on that history.
Yeah, I think there's a... Yes, I think you need to go back to history and not watch Sunday night TV.
Me and Poldark will never be separated. Anyway, it is a film, isn't it? I mean, it's a, for those of you who have yet to go to the bookshop and buy Simon's book, it is a headlong, adventurous, muscular, exciting, lively tale. I mean, it rollicks along. It feels like a film.
Well, there is okay, well, briefly, the story on that is when I had the idea of writing this story, my literary agent said, can you write a synopsis? And I'd never written a synopsis before. So I wrote 4 pages outlining the 5 acts. And on the basis of that, he sold the film rights to a woman called Tessa Ross, who was the executive producer of Slumdog Millionaire and 12 Years a Slave. So she bought it. The screenplay has been written by Jack Thorne, who wrote the Harry Potter play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And very shortly, the Philip Pullman, His Dark Materials, is going to be on BBC One. He's written that, and he's doing the new Star Wars film. So, you know, he knows what he's doing. And I've read the screenplay, which is a very unusual experience. But that doesn't, none of this means it's going to be a film. But, you know, I hope that it will be. And he and Jack's, you know, his reputation is pretty solid.
And who's your ideal cast, apart from Aidan Turner?
I think Aidan Turner's a little bit feeble, really. Aidan Turner wouldn't last 5 minutes in my prison, let me tell you that. All that swanning around in a shirt. And
he'd last a bit longer in mine. I'd put him in solitary with me. Yeah. Anyway, back to you. The ideal cast.
Yes. I'll put him in a chemisette, certainly, and then see what happens. I honestly have no idea. I mean, the thing about the three main characters, King Dick is one, Joe and Habs are the other two main characters. Joe is 16 and Habs is 17. I don't know who's a spectacular actor. There'll be new actors, I suspect. The only time I've seen a film recently is there's an actor called Charlie Plummer, who is exceptional. And when I went to see a film that he was in, I looked at him and I thought, that's exactly what my Joe looks like. So this is, so I don't know, but it's a great opportunity. King Dick is slightly, he's like the, I don't know, he's 6'7". It's a great opportunity for somebody. Mind you, having said that, if you're a fan of the Jack Reacher books by Lee Child, they become a movie as well. And Jack Reacher, is the one thing we know about him is he's 6'6", 6'7", and in the movie he's played by Tom Cruise. And the one thing we know about Tom Cruise is he ain't 6'7". He's barely 5'7". So frankly, who knows who's going to play King Dick? But I have a few ideas, but I'm not going to be mentioning them out loud.
Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks. It's kind of not in my... It's not really up to me anymore, but...
No, but I mean...
Thank you very much.
Right? We'll have a showing here at Greenbelt. So, two questions. Probably best if you stand up and do your best, and I'll repeat what I think you've said. Any questions? Young man here.
I was wondering, when you were writing the first It book...
Yes. Okay, so this is a question about the Itch book, which was the Element Hunter book, which I started talking about, whether when I was writing the first one, whether I thought there'd be a second one. The answer to that is no. I was just writing a one-off book because I thought my son might like it. When he did like it and when other people expressed an interest in it, I went back and rewrote some of it because they wanted a follow-up. Because, you know, if there's a, everybody wants the next one, don't they? You know, if you read one book, you want the next one in the story, next one in the story. So I went back and wrote it so that it became, there was room for a second story, and then I made room for a third story. But no, when I was writing it, I just thought it would be a one-off book. And then when people, but that's very much the modern way of thinking. That it, in fact, Itch Rocks, which is the second book, when we did the launch for that, the first question I got asked after that is, when's the next one coming out? You know, so if there's this kind of relentless idea of getting the next book through. So Itch was originally conceived as a one-off, but then it became a two-off and then a three-off. And who do, maybe one day I'll write a fourth, but...
This is, feels like a sequel, do you?
Do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. That's a very interesting, it's a very interesting thought.
More questions? Oh, gentleman over there.
Well, it's a very. I hope a lot of you heard that question. It was a very learned question. The essence of it why would King Dick be interested in putting on Romeo and Juliet? Well, obviously we're into acts of imagination here. I think that it's a rollicking good story. That's probably the first reason that he wanted to tell the story. Also, Juliet, the first Juliet ever that we know of was a man. So. Audiences were used to seeing an all-male cast. I can think of no other... I mean, basically, I think he seemed to have loved... He learned to love Shakespeare. There are a number of reasons why he might have done that. Shakespeare was certainly very well established in the United States by then anyway. He learned it on the ships. There were various kind of like showbiz versions, shortened versions of Romeo and Juliet and other plays which were performed on the ships. But I think I understand the way where you're coming from. His production is pretty racy, but the dynamic in the book which gets them into trouble is not the fact that Romeo and Juliet are both men, because they're all used to that, because what else are you going to do in a prison? But the fact is that Romeo is white. Juliet is white and Romeo is black. That's the issue. And the agent says, you're not doing that. You're absolutely not doing that. I will not have that on the stage. So that's why it's particular. That's at one scene five is the kiss where they meet. They've met like five minutes before and then they kiss straight away. And that's the moment on stage which becomes hugely important and significant. Sorry, it's a rambly answer to your question. But we're getting somewhere towards, I think, why King Dick would have wanted to do the play.
And there's a lot of fighting in Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it starts with a fight. And, well, in fact, it actually starts with the chorus. I love the thing about Romeo and Juliet, and a lot of you know this anyway, it starts with the chorus come on, and they tell you what's going to happen. They tell you how long it's going to be. They say it's 2 hours. It's a whole lot longer than that. And they tell the line about star-crossed lovers comes right at the very beginning. So my version of that is that it starts with a funeral hymn which is being sung and I've changed the hymn slightly so it makes a reference to star-crossed lovers. But I love the idea of a chorus coming on and just telling you, hang on, this is going to be great, it's going to be tragic, it's going to last 2 hours, 20 minutes, and you're going to have a great time. So that's what the chorus do.
More questions, I think there were, from that part of the room. Maybe there weren't. Maybe it was from this part of the room. Sir?
Yeah, where did the segregation come from? No, what happened was the white sailors went to the agent, they went to the British governor and said, we want to be separate. And the governor, to his eternal shame, said yes. So that, and I think he said yes because he thought he was being practical, he thought it would be easier because there was a lot of tension in the prison, and he thought everything will be easy if we separate them all out. So it was very much one-sided. What's interesting is that because of the separation, because of the segregation, what flourished in prison four was the choir and these drama productions, which you, I have to wonder whether they would actually have emerged if everyone had still been mixed up, you know. So that's quite interesting and dangerous at the same time. But no, the segregation was a request specifically from the white sailors to the governor, to the agent. Yes.
How do you say it?
Colony in Australia.
That's in Australia. Are you aware of that, and have you been influenced by it at all?
I have been told about it and told that I need to take note, but it's too late because I did. But when you start telling a story and someone says, oh, you must watch this because it's a similar kind of idea, my reaction is to do exactly the opposite and not watch it, because you think that I don't want it to or I've already got the influence of Romeo and Juliet. I don't want to have another influence in there. But no, I have heard that story, and I need to make room for it next, which I will do. Thank you for reminding me of it.
You've obviously always had a love of reading, love of books. How has that changed now you've started writing them yourself?
So the question is, had a love of books, and how has that changed now that I'm writing them? It I mean, I read a lot of books for work, and that changes the way you read as well. Because if you're reading because you know you're going to be interviewing the person, you kind of you take it in a different way. I guess the same as anything, the more you read, you kind of spot what an author might be doing. You know, he introduces a character, or there's a little bit of sleight of hand, and you think, oh, okay, I've spotted that. Just because, as in any job, you tend to notice these things the more you kind of operate in that area. So I think you just get slightly more analytical and slightly more professional. But a really good, you know, a really good book, you get lost in as much as anyone would. I'm reading the new Lee Child at the moment, and you just sort of marvel at this astonishing creation that he's come up with. So sometimes you can spot the tricks, and sometimes not.
What's the best book you've ever read? Desert Island Discs type.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess I would say probably that we're back to Philip Pullman and the His Dark Materials trilogy. I think that's where I normally end up, just because as a feat of imaginative writing, I don't think I've read anything more startling than that. His whole, you know, starting with Northern Lights. I love Subtle Knife particularly. I thought that was great. Although I had a conversation with Jack Thorne after I said, I love Subtle Knife. And he said, no, I've kind of blended that into the first one. I'm like, okay, well, you obviously know a whole lot better than I do. But I love Subtle Knife. But I love that whole world of demons which he creates. And if anyone else remembers Northern Lights, very early on in the book, there's a reference to Pope John Calvin. This is the kind of thing you can say at Greenbelt. And as soon as he said Pope John Calvin, I thought, oh, okay, this isn't our world then. This is a slightly distorted world. So I just thought he was completely brilliant. And so I would probably go there, I would think.
And what's the worst book?
I forget the bad ones. I've read a few Christian books that are rubbish. Though I remember there was a book... Oh, what was it? David, it wasn't David Watson, but it was David C. Watson. He was an American creationist. And I remember being given that as a teenager, and it was just tripe. But that, I don't know if that's a good answer or not. Oh, that is a good answer. Okay.
Well, someone thinks it is.
You had it as well. It was illustrated. It was pants.
Another question?
What question would I ask King Dick? What a brilliant question. I think everything would go back to his love of Shakespeare. And because we know nothing about him until he arrives in Dartmoor, and then the British have the records, and we know how tall he was, and we know what he looked like. But how he emerged as this fully formed king in this prison, where he came from, what his upbringing was, where he learnt to love Shakespeare. I find it just amazing that he basically took over prison for within a few weeks of arriving. You know, he hadn't been there for years. He arrived in October. By November, he was in charge. He was known as King Dick. You know, so I think it's his background, finding out where he came from and where he got to love Shakespeare. I think that would be probably what I'd ask him. But it's a good question. Sorry, can you repeat the question? I wasn't quite sure what that was. How do I feel about reading and writing and spelling? Well, that's a very good question, because as people who've seen me write know, my spelling is not great, and sometimes my punctuation isn't great. But when I do talks in schools, what I say to the kids is the most important thing. You know, the idea is what matters. The characters are what matter. You can get the spelling right later. Someone else can say your grammar is slightly wrong there. But the idea, the spark, that's the most exciting thing. And if you've got the idea, then go with that. So I would say I love the writing, and I love reading, and my spelling isn't quite as good as it should be. But I'm getting there. Oh, poems. I know a couple of... I have some good friends who are poets, and I'm happy to leave it to them. me and poetry don't really go together, I don't think.
Never say never. Question at the middle. Middle?
How old was King Dick? He was 27 when he arrived. Yeah. Why did it take so long for them to be released? Okay, so peace is declared on December 31st, 1814, but April the 5th, 1815, they're still in the prison. This is the reason why it ends in the massacre. And basically, partly it's the reality of life in 1814, so that the British ratify the treaty straight away. The treaty then set sail for America. It then has to be discussed and debated in Congress. Congress vote, they pass it, then it has to come back to the UK. Then there's a lot of squabbling between Britain and America as to who pays for sending the sailors home. So then it gets lost in bureaucracy. Meantime, the prison is turning into a powder keg. So basically, it's a combination of the reality of life in the early 19th century, but also the bureaucratic arguments which took place between the two governments. But, you know, and it was fatal for a whole bunch of the sailors.
One more question? Oh, right at the back over there.
Having written a story, you were sorry, so framework was there based on Romeo and Juliet, and you kind of build a story around that. Is it easier to do that as a writer or to have a completely original story in and of itself?
Okay, so the question is, if I heard everything right, was is it more difficult to come up with a completely new story or to sort of hang it around Romeo and Juliet? I think it's easier to come up with a completely new story. Hanging it around Romeo and Juliet, it gave it a structure, but actually made it more difficult, because I was trying to the idea was to, it's not a retelling of Romeo and Juliet, but some of the characters in the story represent the original characters in Romeo and Juliet. So I've got a Benvolio, and I got a Romeo and I got a Juliet, and there's a nurse as well. So actually, I think I created a rod for my own back by trying to reflect the Romeo and Juliet throughout. I've kind of assumed that most people don't know that much about Romeo and Juliet, that they know it's a romance and they know it kind of doesn't end well. That's all I've assumed that people know, and a part, you know, but so I think it's easier to start with a completely blank sheet rather than to try and emulate William Shakespeare on balance.
And is your book, Mad Blood Stirring by Simon Mayo, available on the Greenbelt site?
Well, it certainly was about an hour ago. So unless there's been a sudden rush, I would imagine there are copies. I should say, actually, by the way, so you see the cover, the artwork, which I do like very much. We went to the book launch. I went to the book launch. It was my book launch, so obviously I had to be there. At the book launch, we did the thing, and it was great. And we had some young actors from WAC Arts in North London acting out Act 1, Scene 5, and there were speeches, and there was wine and cheese and that kind of stuff. And when we got home, my eldest son said to my wife, "Shall I show him then?" Which is always makes a parent nervous. What's he going to show me? Anyway, and he then undid his shirt and took it off like that, and he's had that tattooed into his shoulder. So, you know, like permanent and everything. So I didn't feel...
What, Mad Blood Stirring?
No, the eagle. Just the eagle. Just the eagle. So he's got this clawed eagle coming in over... I mean, it's very touching, really. So I couldn't say, what have you done that for? That's going to be with you forever. So it has. My publisher suggested that my next book should have a pink handbag on the front. And that'll be a test, you know, to see whether he's devoted or not. Anyway, so, yeah.
Are you signing them? Are you signing them in the bookshop?
Or? I'm doing tattoos, actually. That's the. If you would like a tattoo done like that, then I will be performing. Yes, I shall go over to the tent and sign some if people would like to. Me too.
Well, straight after this session?
Straight after this session, yes. Well, would that be convenient?
Yeah, that's great. Okay. They're ready. You're ready, bookshop. Yeah, they're ready. So all that remains is for me to thank you for being such a great friend to Greenbelt for 41
years! Thank you very much. Thank you.
And thank you. You've been a lovely audience. Thank you.